Welcome to the Chase Down Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Roan. The Cleveland Cavaliers are not that fun to talk about right now. The team is pretty damn bad. Kevin Love's going to be out a little longer than he was initially anticipating, which validates Carter's theories on the last podcast.
And pow!
Things are just generally bleak. So we figured we'd do a little bit of a special podcast. First, I guess, I always do this when we have a guest. I don't like introducing you, Carter, but I guess I'll do it. How's it going, Carter?
Worse now.
Well, just
go ahead.
You're doing good. You go with the flow really easily, man.
Yeah, which, you know, whatever. It's fine. Just introduce Trevor.
Okay. We brought back our friend, recurring guest, and draft expert. We're going to call you draft expert, Trevor, because you're one of the smartest draft people I know, Trevor Magnotti. Trevor, how's it going, man?
It's good. I look forward to being a beacon of light on what has been a very depressing season for the Cavs.
Now, Carter and I have been a little bit divided recently, so obviously there's two options that are on the top of everyone's minds. Are you team Hedo or team Anis?
I don't think there's a winner in that fight. I think it's just all bad.
Jesus.
Anytime you can start the podcast with geopolitical discussion. Well,
hoops hype sure tried.
Exactly.
I was not ready for that joke, Justin, but I'm glad you went there. As David Zavek said on the pod recently, no one asked Jetty about this, please. I don't want the opportunity for a disappointing answer. And he plays with the national team, so I don't want to hear it.
On the plus side, he's not actually from there, so that does help. Yeah, he wasn't born there. Right. He was just brought over through, I'm sure, very legal and very acceptable means as a child.
Right. Naturally. Where is he from originally again?
Macedonia, I forget.
Macedonia.
There you go.
For those that don't know, there was a poll on Twitter basically asking if people are team Hedo and team Anis, which is a really weird question when one's trying to poison and assassinate the other.
Pretty dark little short story there. I was actually just thinking about how Trevor is probably our most recurring guest outside of Mort, and we couldn't really have two different recurring guests in terms of preparation. In terms of disposition,
yeah, one is very, very different. Full sex jokes. The other one's Trevor.
Oh man! Also, I do like it whenever we have Trevor on because the only time anyone ever learns anything from this podcast.
That's true.
And furthermore, Trevor, I would like to, you know, we're a surly pair from time to time. We like to make jokes at one another's expenses, but I will like to make a brief compliment, which is you are one of the few draft people who isn't so fucking insufferable about everything. And I really appreciate that because even the ones who are right, it's what's the Rick and Morty thing? It's like, I don't care that you're right because you're just such an asshole. No one wants to give you the satisfaction.
Pretty much.
Even when people are right, most of the time I'm like, God damn, could you be worse about this? So we appreciate you, Trevor.
Of course. It gets very granular with what we do kind of by trade, and that can bring out some negative opinions, especially when we spend all year doing this and investing so much time in trying to break these guys down just for the sliver of hope that we might actually have an idea what's going on. And then April and May roll around and everybody suddenly has an opinion and it's just starting from square one again. It is very frustrating for us. And that is kind of why a majority of us are like this, but I do try to keep a level head there just because
I just I like that you can
get there.
My favorite, I just think like when you're talking about, and this is a little off course, but I do think like when you're talking about the draft, it's okay to talk in absolutes about some things. Like he has a good handle. He can shoot. But like oh, he isn't a player, or this guy is no doubt the number one pick. If you don't draft him number one, you are a moron. Like that kind of stuff just kills me. When we can all acknowledge we don't know what we're talking about yet, are managing to be so insufferable about this kind of stuff. It's just, it boggles the mind. But to that end, Justin, don't you think Zion Williamson's just going to get hurt and be Anthony Bennett 2.0?
That's a great, great transition. And you know what? I was trying to unpack a little bit kind of my Zion fears. And I think there's a few factors here. And Trevor, this is the main reason you're on, is to help
me. Just talk Justin down.
Off the ledge.
So I think part of it is maybe a defense mechanism over just how slim the odds are that the Cavs are going to end up with the number one pick. Because I do think if you have the top pick, as much as I have trepidation surrounding Zion, I think he is kind of the guy that you have to take there. But for me, what I'm hoping for is for the Cavs to get number two, because I don't want to pass on Zion, but I want guys that at least make a little more sense, that there's historical comparisons to, that theoretically might be able to shoot. And like, Zion just freaks me out, like from a durability standpoint, just because he's so big and he lands like Derrick Rose all the time. And I also just, my other concern is that his wingspan isn't big enough to defend fives consistently, and his handle's not really good enough to play on the perimeter, and he doesn't have a jumper. So I get scared. I understand the upside with him, but he scares the living crap out of me. Tell me why he's the best prospect in this draft.
Well, I think that you make a good point where there's not really a good statistical comparison to him, in addition to the fact that there's not a good physical comparison to him. You know, we haven't seen a guy who is this athletic at his weight who isn't Shaq, basically, in college before. And we haven't seen a player be this productive at the college level in every aspect of the game since Anthony Davis. If you run any number of statistical numbers on the Sports Reference Play Index for college basketball, in the last 10 years, the only player you consistently run into on those lists is Anthony Davis, in terms of positive impact for advanced metrics, in terms of the scoring production combined with the defensive production that he has. That's why so many people are gravitating towards him as the number one pick. It's a kind of a perfect storm where you get everybody gets what they want with Zion. You get the guy, you get the highlight guys who only care about, you know, the crossovers and the dunks. They get as many highlights as they want. The natural draft observers who watch a ton of tape, you watch him and you can clearly see that he is another level of athlete from even your top level that you normally see in the draft. And then you have the analytics to back up what you're seeing on that tape. And I think that's what makes him so special, especially compared to the rest of this class, which, while it's not the worst class in the world, and I will continue to go to bat for it, the class as a whole is not as bad as it has the reputation for. It definitely does not have guys who are at the same level as what Williamson has put out so far at this level. And I think that's the overarching thing with him. Yeah, there are some durability concerns. Yeah, there are some negatives to his game, but it's very hard to be this productive in college and not have it translate to the NBA level.
How do you, something that I found interesting about him is, you know, I don't think anyone's projecting him as a three anymore. It feels like he's a four or a five. He's not very big. How do you think, what position do you see him playing at the next level the most often?
I think he's a playmaking four. I think that he's going to be spending a lot of time next to a bigger center who can handle, you know, your Carl Anthony Towns, is your Porzingis, is the taller guys who he's not going to be able to really match up well against. But I think he can handle himself pretty well as a rim protector and as a rebounder at the NBA level. I think that his leaping ability cancels out so many of the height concerns, because he has a vertical that is not only impressive just in terms of its raw, you know, number of inches, but he also uses it functionally very well. You know, he can explode off of 2 feet, off of 1 foot, and be able to get a pretty similar height when he goes up to contest the shot. And it's one of the quickest jumps that we've seen in the last couple of years. So he has a really good ability to kind of appear out of nowhere and make these blocks when he's not really in good position while at Duke. And I think that that's really promising for developing his skill set as a weak side shot blocker. And I think that's going to be what ultimately keys him into that role as a full-time big. Because if he didn't have that, I'd be a lot more concerned about what his positional value is at the NBA level. With that, I think that he can be a guy that can play on the perimeter, can take possessions at the elbow and be able to create some offense, and then turn around and be able to guard fours and fives pretty comfortably, be able to switch when needed, and be able to protect the rim a little bit. I think that he has that versatility to be able to be a little bit more fluid, and he's not going to be just like a Blake Griffin type that is full-time four without that ability to play the five, just because Blake, for all of his leaping ability, didn't really have that instinct to be a shot blocker in the way that Williamson seems to have.
Right. When you say that you kind of envision him as being someone that can attack from the elbow, is that just kind of raw athleticism that he's going to be able to overpower guys and get by them? Because when I watch at Duke, and maybe this isn't a fair characterization of his game, maybe it's just a result of who he's playing against that he's able to create for himself in transition and off of offensive rebounds. I don't really see them dump the ball to him and have him create. Like, and I think that's one of the criticisms, is that I don't think Coach K necessarily is using any of these guys really well. And there aren't a whole lot of creative ways to get Zion the ball. And he just makes it happen with kind of sheer will and athleticism. Like, do you think his handle, is it just going to be him getting by kind of slower big men in the NBA, or do you think that it's something that he's going to be able to develop and kind of get by other perimeter players if you throw one on him?
Well, I think that's where his size comes into play. I think that he's so good at this point at leveraging his strength in terms of just getting by perimeter players. You know, at the beginning of the season, he was kind of more of a straight line guy, a guy who could only attack really coming downhill off of like a secondary pick and roll, and who really needed that open lane to the rim, didn't have a ton of shake. He's shown a little bit more of that as the season goes on, and he's done a really good job of using his shoulders as a weapon on drives. And I think if you stick a smaller guy on him, he's going to be able to get that kind of James Harden-esque dip the shoulder, get into the guy, and kind of create that little bit of separation to be able to get a clean shot off, in addition to potentially drawing fouls with that as well. I think that he is going to be able to use his combination of strength and coordination to be able to throw those smaller guys who are quicker than him and can cut off his space and be able to kind of get them out of their rhythm. And I think that that's something that's going to be helpful for him. I don't know if he's ever going to be a guy who's going to be, you know, bring up the ball, primary ball hand or running pick and rolls left and right. But I think
I can't see that personally.
Yeah. If you put him in a situation where he's catching the ball coming maybe off a screen or off of the 3-point line, running off of a screen from a big or even a guard, if you're running a more small ball offense, I think that he's capable enough of having a little bit of shake to get guys off balance, using his strength to be able to leverage his way to the rim, and also he can make those simple little reads in the few pick and roll possessions he has gotten at Duke. He's done a good job of making those small little passes to maybe like hit a pick and pop or be able to hit RJ Barrett or Cameron Reddish sitting on the 3-point line. And I think that that's really promising. I think that he's a guy that, while maybe not isn't your primary ball handler, can definitely be your secondary creator in an offense.
So I'm a little, my biggest anxiety about Zion actually is not as much to do with his game. I think I'm just anxious about just about anyone at this point, just because I don't really trust the Cavs to do it right, which seems pretty well-founded right now.
Plus also just for the worst-case scenario to happen, no matter who they draft.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I guess my biggest anxiety with Zion is actually kind of a roster construction question, which is, you know, and when you're as bad as the Cavs are, you really can't make any positional concessions when you're drafting. But, you know, you're saying he's a playmaking four. Kevin Love plays the four, and they just signed him to a 4-year extension. They also just signed Larry Nance to big money, and they're already paying Tristan Thompson big money. I'm not sure how that shakes out. Obviously, if you want Zion, you take Zion. But I guess you, I would probably just start Love at the five. It's a bit of a weird spot.
Yeah, I think that that is actually a pretty good fit. The pairing of Zion and Love makes a lot of sense on paper because you do have that kind of developing potential to be a rim protector from Williamson, which is going to help with a lot of the defensive concerns that we've always had with Love at the five. And having him as a floor spacer that can also create a little bit of offense and rebound well, I think is going to help fill in some of the gaps with where he's going to have some weaknesses, especially early on. The fit with Tristan is very clunky, and the fit with Nance is probably also a little bit clunky, especially because he doesn't have that three-point shot right now. And as good as Nance has been at that at times this year, I don't think that that's something that's projectable moving forward in a reliable way. I do think that they're going to have to kind of delineate some of that in the future, either that's trading Thompson or dealing Nance.
It certainly feels to me like a Zion draft would spell the end of Tristan Thompson in Cleveland sooner rather than later.
Yeah, it just, that is the one fit that I think does not work when you look at the Cavs' other front court options, trying to pare him down, just because there's just a lot of overlap in, honestly, the defensive skill set. You know, I think that you've got two guys who can kind of do similar things, but aren't different enough on offense where Zion doesn't have that shooting threat to be able to compensate for Tristan. And Tristan's got that little bit of playmaking ability, but it's not like you can go like five out and have multiple creating fives like you do with Love. That fit is definitely something that's cause for concern. And that would be a very interesting question to see how they navigate if they do end up with Zion as one of their either a first or second pick.
That's my big anxiety, is like with Zion as well, is like, you know, you're already talking about the centers that can't play with them. There's no one that I can see that like, oh, you can't play him with Barrett. You know, like there, like Zion does demand, or Reddish, or, you know, a lot of these guys. And I am a little concerned at like having to make positional concessions for my best player.
Yeah, but I think that's where it comes into where, you know, where are the Cavs realistically at in their roster building process? You know,
I guess my question, Trevor, is if you are building a roster around Zion Williamson, is it functionally a requirement that your center be able to shoot threes?
I think it is, at least for the first few years. I think that the jumper is teachable. I think that we have seen that with so many guys who have come out in recent years. You can, at this point, teach anybody to be a functional catch and shoot spot up shooter, especially.
No one told Lonzo.
Well, as long as you don't have to do a huge mechanics overhaul, which you don't really have to do with Zion. I mean, for all of the hand wringing about his 3-point shooting, he's shooting 53% on 2-point field goals so far. And that's what you want to see. You want to see a guy who has a solid foundation that can potentially eventually stretch that out to three. And I think that Zion fits in that category. He has pretty functional mechanics. You just really have to tighten up how quickly he's able to go from the catch to his actual release, because his gather is a little bit of a process at this point. And I think once he gets that down, he's going to be able to get that confidence up, and he's going to be able to start taking more of those spot up 3-point attempts. So I think that you can teach him, but for year one and two, I think that that's going to be a little bit more of a process. And if you're looking to him to be a foundational core piece, which you definitely should, you want to have pieces around him who can compensate for that. And that's going to mean leaning more towards Love and, to a degree, Nance, than going towards the non-shooting centers.
I think Zion just, like, there's so many things about him that just kind of go with all of my insecurities. The durability being a big one, that's something that nobody can really project. But just because we haven't seen someone that big that jumps that high and lands that way constantly, it freaks me out to some extent. And then I wonder, given how raw he is offensively, and given that the fact that the handle isn't good enough to necessarily play on the perimeter, and he doesn't have the wingspan in case if some of that athleticism goes, that type of stuff makes me really nervous. And then it's also just the fact that he isn't currently a shooter. Like, it, that just goes against kind of like the fundamentals of guys that I typically like to root for. But as I said, I still think that if you have the top pick, that's likely the guy you go with, just because he is that anomaly that it's tough to project what he is, because he's the first Zion Williamson. And it's always fun when you draft a guy that that's a unique talent, that's the first to ever be like that. But I understand that both RJ and Cam aren't necessarily lighting the world on fire at Duke. They both had their flaws. I don't like Cam Reddish being basically reduced to a spot-up threat in the corner. I think RJ hasn't exactly been put in situations to succeed, and he might have been pressing a little bit. Although it does seem like lately he's kind of cutting out a little bit of that mid-range, and he's taking more threes and getting to the rim a little bit more, which I like to see. But what are your thoughts on the other two, at least in relation to Zion? Like, do you think that there's a real cliff and a drop-off there? Or do you think kind of the gaps in production has more to do with playing in the college game, and that this might be something that changes when they go to the next level?
I think that way more with Barrett than with Reddish at this point. I think that Reddish gives me some big concerns that he's actually going to be more than what he's being put in as his role in at Duke. I think
there's Wiggins vibes there, right?
Well, I think that there's a little bit of that, just in terms of his handle is kind of gnarly at this point. He does not have the ability to reliably put the ball on the deck and even be able to attack a simple closeout consistently at this point, and that's very concerning. He is very turnover prone when he puts the ball on the floor. But I do think that he's a little bit beyond, you know, that Wiggins vibe, because he is such a good spot up shooter at this point. You know, his numbers haven't really reflected it, but he's shooting a huge volume of threes. And I think that he's got the mechanics and he's got the foundation in terms of the footwork, both rotating around on the perimeter and coming off screens, to more fit like a Klay Thompson mold, where he's a guy who you can reliably ask to take six or seven threes a game and eventually be able to knock down 36, 37, 38% of those and be able to be a very effective spot-up shooter that kind of takes that next level from, you know, maybe a guy like Rodney Hood, or just using a foundational example, to Jalen Jones, who good three-point shooter, but you can't ask him to do anything more than stand still on the three-point line and then catch and release. I think that Reddish has a lot more potential in terms of his ability to shoot off movement than anybody else in the draft class, and I think that's what I like most about him. Barrett, I think that he has a lot more potential. I think that he's the other guy in this class that has definite star potential in terms of his ability to create his own offense, his ability to find teammates and be able to make pretty advanced passes. I think the big thing with him, though, is just we're not seeing the mental side of the game catch up to where his skill set is. And I think that's the big concern. He misses a lot of easy reads when he is running a pick and roll and isolating that would free up really good opportunities for other players in the Duke offense, and he kind of gets tunnel vision at certain points. And even more than just the mid-range tendencies, I think that's what scares me most about Barrett, is I think he's kind of one of those guys who, while he may have star-level talent and he may have star-level production in the NBA, he kind of feels like one of those guys that is the wrong type of star, where he can be your number one option, but he puts a cap on what your team is able to be at the NBA level.
Right, but when you're talking about those weaknesses, part of my confusion with him is, That might be weaknesses when you're talking about, okay, can he be a point forward that's running the whole offense, that's kind of a central hub like a LeBron or Giannis. But if he doesn't show growth there, which I agree with you that you do see flashes of that, like you do see good passing and his assist rate overall is pretty decent, but he does miss guys. But even if that skill doesn't necessarily grow, doesn't that just kind of make him like almost a better Jason Tatum? like a guy that you can't necessarily build around, but still a really damn good player. Because I think their games are like fairly
subtle Tatum shade.
Well, no, it's not even Tatum shade. I'm saying, like, if you look at their numbers at Duke, it's they're fairly comparable players. I think Barrett has a better skill set at that point than Tatum did even.
Yeah, and I think the thing that makes that comparison even better is the fact that Tatum was so similar to Barrett in terms of the aesthetics of his game while he was at Duke. Both guys looked like completely different players in high school than they did once they got in the blue and black under Coach K. They kind of got pigeonholed into this role where, okay, you're going to shoot a lot of mid-range shots, you're going to get a lot of on-ball time, but your offensive capability is going to be kind of, it almost felt like disjointed from the rest of the Duke offense. That's the vibe that I get watching Barrett, and that's the vibe I remember getting watching Tatum. And I think that's
why the Rudy Gay comparisons came out for Tatum.
Yep, and the Melo comparisons too. And I think that is why we're seeing a lot of kind of doubt about what Barrett can actually be in terms of value to a winning franchise. And I think that when you reframe it from Barrett being, you know, he's going to be probably a number one or number two pick, and you reframe it from him, okay, this is a guy that needs to be your future number one scorer, to this is a guy who needs to be able to dictate at least part of your offense and needs to be kind of a complementary piece, I think that it becomes a lot more palatable, because then you don't have to rely on him being the one guy that constantly is getting to the rim. You don't have to rely on him as being the guy who's going to get everybody else involved. And that, I think, is a lot more palatable when you think of him as maybe the secondary or third star. But then again, if you're the team picking second, especially when you're a team that has the talent level that the Cavs do right now, is that what excites you? Especially when you're comparing him to Zion, who I think does have that ability to be maybe not your number one offensive initiator, but does have your ability to be the guy who you design your offense around. I don't think that Barrett has that same capability because of those concerns that we're seeing.
If you're picking first overall, Trevor, and you're the Cavaliers, and you have the Cavaliers roster and their inherent intrinsic problems, how hard are you looking at Barrett, or are you pretty much just, do you think Zion is a clear tier above in your estimation?
I think that Zion is a tier above. I am looking at Barrett though, because you do have all of the concerns that we've outlined. You do have the positional fit to take into consideration. You do have the durability question. You do have the fact that you're going to have to put significant work into Williamson's jumper in a way that you don't really have to do that with any real skill outside of strength for Barrett. I think if Barrett can put on a little bit more muscle mass and become a little bit better finisher at the rim, that's what puts him over the edge to being at that same level that Zion is. And I think that that's something that can be pretty workable. It's pretty easy for guys to be able to put on that strength, especially if they've got the frame. And while Barrett does look pretty physically mature at this point, I think he does have a little bit of room to be able to put on a little bit of muscle mass. So I think that while he's, I think, a clear step behind Williamson in terms of what their overall, I think, most likely outcome is going to be, I still am looking at Barrett because I think there is a better path to him being a star on the Cavs than there are on some of the other teams that are going to be picking in the top five.
Would you say RJ is the risk adverse pick almost? Like, is Zion's durability concerns that significant to you that you feel that maybe RJ has a better chance of having a higher floor in the NBA?
I don't think so. I don't really put a lot of as much stock in the durability concerns, whether that's foolish of me or not. You know, he does have some kind of awkward looking landing mechanics, but I have talked to some guys who have specialized in more of kind of that biomechanics and looking at that stuff specifically. And they aren't as concerned with Zion as they are with some other guys who are potential top five picks. In particular, Ja Morant. I've talked to some biomechanics people who are more concerned with his landing style, where he kind of lands with his knees buckling in a little bit more than Williamson does. And they're more concerned with that. I think that the weight concerns are a little bit overblown, especially with the reasonable expectation that he's going to slim down once he gets on an NBA conditioning program. I think that that's less of a concern. So I don't really factor that in as much. I think that it's definitely reasonable to, especially if you're a Cavs fan, because you've seen that story play out before where a guy with questionable conditioning comes in and that doesn't happen for him. I think that's less of the concern. I think more the jumper is the concern if you're the Cavs. Can you teach him to be a reliable shooter, either on catch and shoots at the very minimum, and also, you know, potentially off movement in the future? Do you trust that versus kind of your baseline NBA strength program that Barrett's going to have to go through? And I think it's a little bit more of a reasonable expectation for Barrett to be able to get that going than it is for Zion to get a, you know, a high level jumper.
Well, luckily none of this matters because they're going to rig the lottery for the Knicks to get Zion. So I did want to talk, because I think Cavs fans have been so hyper focused on the Duke trio because they're, you know, the easiest to watch. You know, Nasir Little goes up and down in minutes. Ja Morant plays for Murray fucking State. If the Cavs do, if disaster strikes, let's say the Cavs win a few games when Love comes back, or how the new lottery odds just fuck us. And this team is picking in the 4 to 6 range. Kind of, who do you like in that kind of second to third tier of the draft? And how far, how big of a drop off is it? I haven't quite figured it out yet, because sometimes it feels like they're all kind of, the second tier has 5 or 6 players, and then sometimes it feels like there's quite a big drop off.
Yeah, I think that there are probably like 5 guys in that second tier that I would put behind Zion. I include RJ in that tier because I do have the concerns that, you know, he just ends up kind of in that mold where he's not actually that valuable as an NBA player in terms of roster construction. So I kind of have him in that tier, but he's going to be moving out of it probably eventually if he continues playing like he has over the last couple of weeks. In that tier, I have Reddish, who we've already discussed a little bit. Bol Bol, the center from Oregon, who just broke his foot and is out for the season. So that's exciting.
So he's broken forever. Good to hear.
So my immediate concern with him already came to life. So there we go.
So he's, he go.
Yeah. You know, I like him even as a potential fit on the Cavs, even with all of their centers, because to a degree, he is kind of at the end of the day a 7'2" wing, where he's going to be a guy who's going to be way more valuable on offense than I think he is on defense, because he just doesn't get it on that side. So I still have him as a potential option. The two guys that I'm mainly focused on for the Cavs in kind of that 3-4-5 range, though, would be Nasir Little, who I have not given up on. A lot of draft Twitter has, because he has not put up the same production.
I really like Little.
Yeah, hasn't shown the same, hasn't shown the same ability to make the high level reads that Barrett has. But at the end of the day, he has the best functional jumper of anybody in the class in terms of his ability to just make shots. He is a guy who you can give the ball with 8 seconds left on the shot clock, clear everybody else out, and he'll be able to get you a bucket. I think that's going to be something that's valuable. In addition to the fact that he has a 7'2" wingspan, he's very strong, has the ability to potentially defend 1 through 5 at the NBA level, because he's quick enough and he's strong enough and has the length. I really like him in that potential role. I also like Jarrett Culver, Texas Tech, because he's all of those things that I just said about Nasir Little, except he's actually doing them this season. He's a year older, of course, so we would expect him to be a little bit further along in his development. But he's at least 6'8", 6'9", has a really good wingspan, doesn't really have the same top-tier athleticism as guys like Williamson and Whittle, but functionally is able to get to the rim very well, has kind of a slow-mo Kyle Anderson game almost in his ability to get to the rim while looking like he's really slow at the same time, makes really good reads, and just basically doesn't have any weaknesses. You know, there's not one thing that I point to with Jarrett Culver where I'm really concerned about him having a big weakness at the NBA level. It's more just, is he a guy who is going to be, you know, in the Danny Green tier of wings, where he's really skilled at a couple things and doesn't really have that kind of elite thing that puts him over the top? Or is he a guy more along the Tatum mold, where he's going to be pretty good at everything, maybe doesn't have the one elite skill, but is sub-elite at several different things and is able to provide a lot of different value, especially as a secondary or third player that you're relying on offense? I think that he has that potential. He's the other guy, along with Williamson, who is a statistical outlier this season. So I really like Culver. I have him third on my board right now. I think he's going to definitely be in play, even if the Cavs are picking fifth or sixth, barring some major development where he maybe starts putting up consistently 24, 25 points a game for a big stretch in conference play. I think that he's going to be a guy who's going to be the most undervalued in the draft, and he would be a great fit on the Cavs because he would be able to provide that play off of Love and off of Sexton and would be able to provide that wing stopper on defense that they're really lacking right now. And I think they could build the backbone of a really good defense around Jarrett Culver and Larry Nance.
Well, this is the Cavs, so they'll be like 27th in the league. One guy that, you know, kind of jumps out to me is Ja Morant, who, you know, I actually didn't hear much buzz on coming into the year. I'm not a big draft Nick. Do you think their drafting of Sexton sort of precludes the drafting of a point guard, no matter where they are in the draft, even if they fall down to this, you know, let's say they win a few games and drop down to 7 or 8?
I don't think it does. I think it precludes kind of the right type of point guard. I think that when you're looking at the point guards in this class, I think that you could get away with drafting a couple of the guys, but Morant is not one of them. One of the big things that concerns me with Morant is he kind of has a lot of the same tendencies as Sexton. You know, he's more of a driver. He's not as much of a shooter. He can make simple reads, but he's not going to make wow anybody, and he's not like a pure point guard. I think that he has similar defensive issues to what Sexton does, and I think there's just a lot of overlap there. I think if they're looking at the point guard spot, I think a guy who makes a lot of sense to be able to play next to Sexton, who can maybe play a little bit more of an off-ball role and be able to provide a little bit more of that passing when Sexton's off the floor, is Darius Garland, who again is out for the year. Like half of the lottery is out for the year at this point, which is one of the reasons that this draft is so difficult to project. But Garland is a guy who I think is going to project to being a pretty good off-ball player, even though he, you know, was a pure point guard in his four games at Vanderbilt. I think that he's a guy who can make pretty good reads as a passer, but is going to be more suited for maybe that CJ McCollum role as more of a small two guard, where he has really good mechanics on catch and shoots. He is able to shoot off movement, is a pretty smart cutter, and does have that ability to run those secondary pick and rolls, be able to find guys within the flow of an offense. I really like him as your potential point guard that you might pair with Sexton if you're really going the dual point guard route in that fail-safe where the Cavs are picking 7th or 8th. I think there still is a spot for him. I don't know necessarily if Morant is that same type of guy, just because I do see a lot of overlap with him and Sexton.
How much do you worry about overlap, though? Like, when you're the Cavs, I understand that you took Colin Sexton with the 8th pick in the draft, but don't you just kind of take whoever the best player available is, like the best overall talent? Because I know this is a flawed way to look at things, but even if you look at like the history of eighth overall picks, like stop me when you hear a guy that you're like, okay, well, we have to draft someone else because we have to kind of build around them. We got Frank Ntilikina, Marquise Chriss, Stanley Johnson, Nick Stauskas, KCP, Terrence Ross, Brandon Knight, Al-Farouq Aminu, Jordan Hill, Joe Alexander, Brandon Wright, and the list goes on and on. So I understand that the Cavs have a lot invested in Sexton. He's basically the lone return for Kyrie. And as much as I hope that he pans out, I think you just kind of take the best player available, right?
Yeah, I think that my interpretation of best player available is different than a lot of people's. I think that when you're drafting as a team that is in the rebuilding phase, you want to draft the guy who has the most talent, but you also want to draft the guy who is going to have the best chance at succeeding on your team. So, for example, we're talking about the Cavs already having Colin Sexton. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense for them to have just put this investment in Sexton with that top 10 pick and then turn around and draft a guy who is very, very similar to him. And you're going to have to play both of those guys' minutes. And even if one is better than the other, you're not putting either guy in a position to really succeed unless one is significantly better than the other. I think that that's the one thing. I think the exception there is
like how Dion Waiters was significantly better than Kyrie.
Exactly. You don't want to draft a guy who is a ball dominant scoring guard who doesn't really have a ton of other ways that he can impact the game when you already have a ball-dominant scoring guard. And it's the same thing with big men. You don't want a, you know, dominant elbow creator and then draft another guy who is best used, you know, in those minutes creating from the elbow or on pick and pops. I think that you don't want to put guys in the same spot because then that best player available isn't the best player available. He is a guy who may have more talent than other guys around him in the same tier, but functionally on your team, he's never going to have the chance to be able to live up to that supposed ceiling because you're putting these limitations on him by either putting him next to guys in similar skill sets or by limiting their playing time that they would need to be able to develop. A good example I go to here is Malik Monk in Charlotte. Great all-around shooter at Kentucky. Really had the potential to be a guy who you could run off a ton of screens, be able to put in a lot of situations where he would be able to play off Kemba Walker really well and be able to get kind of those secondary creation moments. Except they didn't do that because they had Jeremy Lamb to do the same stuff, and he was better at it and probably still is better at it this year. So even though Lamb has less potential than Monk does, Monk is the better functional player, and your coach is going to pick the guy who's going to help you win more games that season. So, ergo, Lamb ends up playing more for the Hornets. I think that you'd run into a similar situation with Sexton and Morant because I think they're similar talent level. Sexton's a year ahead of Morant. I think that Sexton would end up playing more by default, and Morant would kind of be put in more of a role that doesn't suit him or just wouldn't end up getting the minutes that he needs to be able to develop correctly.
Would it be the same thing with Kevin Porter Jr.? Because that's a guy I like, but I could see those type of issues coming up with those two.
Yeah, I think that that's a little bit different just because I think that you can use Porter in ways that would be beneficial playing with Sexton. I think the main thing there is Porter's always going to be a really good transition weapon next to Sexton in the open court because he's better filling the lane on breaks and he doesn't have to have the ball to be an effective player in the way that some of the more ball dominant guards in the class do. I'm not 100% in on Porter yet, mostly because I'm not sure that he is able to think the game at a high enough level. And also, you know, another guy, he's been out for almost 2 months now with an injury and might not come back this season.
Well, he doesn't think the game, so he'll fit right in with this team.
Yeah. So I like him a little bit better, but he's another guy in that range where it's kind of, it's like Porter, Keldon Johnson, and Ja Morant and Coby White, where I see all those guys and I think, yeah, that could be a really good player, but those are not the type of guys who are going to develop well with what we know about how this team develops prospects. I just don't see any of those guys working well either with the development staff, even if the roster ends up working out, particularly in Porter and Johnson's case. I just don't see those guys getting to the point where they're actually worth the investment. I think there are guys that maybe a little bit further down the line who may not be as good of prospects. I look at DeAndre Hunter of Virginia, for example, who could become better players for the Cavs, even though they don't have as high a ceilings.
That makes sense. Something I've been kind of wondering, in my dumb little brain of mine, is the Cavs first round pick is obviously top 10 protected this year. There is no fucking way that's going to the Hawks, but people forget it, that protection does roll over to next year. And do you think there's any player in this draft that will put the Cavs in danger of conferring that pick next year? Or do you expect even if Zion, no matter who they draft, you still expect them to be kind of low? And this is for Justin or Trevor, because I kind of don't see a big jump even with adding a top end talent.
I think there's a path where Zion or RJ could make them competitive. I think that the only way that doesn't happen is you've got to have Kevin Love fully healthy and be just a perfect fit with one of those two guys just blossoming and being like a clear cut away best, looking like the best player in the draft. Like, you have to get Jason Tatum last year, maybe not at that quite that level, but in terms of that type of production that fits well with Kevin Love, with some roster moves around. I just think there's too many things that would have to go right for the Cavs not to be, and at least probably non-competitive next year. I think that there's a chance where they're maybe winning like 30, 35 games. I do not think there's a chance where they're like competing for a playoff spot.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And I think a big part of that is like Sexton also has to take a huge leap.
Yeah,
because he's still going to be running the offense at the end of the day,
mm-hmm.
Barring them just giving up on him, which on its own merits makes it very unlikely that this team is competing for a playoff spot. So, Justin, what do you think?
I mean, personally, I'm a little more optimistic.
You tend to be.
Yes, especially if Kevin Love does stay healthy for the full year. Like, the thing is, there still is such a drop off in the East that after five teams, and maybe things change if Durant goes to New York along with Kyrie. But I still think that the bottom kind of two playoff spots would be kind of there for the taking. And yes, Sexton would need to take a leap, and Jetty would need to be a passable player as well. But I do think that, like, let's say you end up with RJ and it's Sexton, Jetty, RJ, Love, and Tristan, Nance off the bench, and you make a couple of roster moves, guys that help highlight that core that's there.
Bear in mind, it's going to be difficult to make roster moves given that the Cavs have been trading for bad contracts that extend past this season.
Okay, fair.
Just making that point, because I do think that matters, because if people are going to come into this offseason with dreams of drafting Zion and making a decent mid-level splash, it's like, well, they're buttoned up against the luxury tax, so we have to be smart about kind of assuming that they might not make any moves that of that nature.
Yeah. Well, you're right. You're absolutely right. I think we're going to know kind of how much flexibility the Cavs have once this deadline comes in a month. I think the trade deadline is going to be very informative in that way. And who knows, maybe there's a shocking thing that without Kevin Love even playing, he gets moved or something crazy like that. Or if Tristan gets moved, I think that also would hurt them a lot. I do think that there's the possibility for it, just given how bad the East is. But I don't necessarily need to make the playoffs. I think like a competitive team that makes sense with how they play together would work the most for me. And
I just want to build towards something. That's right. What I want more than anything. Get a coach with good player development reputation. And
Yeah, I think there's a chance they might lose the pick. Like, I think that...
I don't think so.
I think that that's a possibility. They might fall into that kind of nowhere land where you didn't make playoffs and you still lose the pick.
That would be so brutal.
it would be far from ideal for sure. But at least with the new lottery odds, you'd have a better shot at jumping up than you used to.
Dude, I'm actually like, I know that Justin, you've been kind of lamenting that the new lottery odds because they're going to burn us. But like, I just keep thinking about like, what if the team that finishes is in the West with the 14th best odds somehow jumps or something like that? I know those odds haven't changed that much, but like
no, for sure.
Remember how kind of cool it was when the Bulls won the Rose lottery? It was like, oh, that team is already pretty good and they're getting Rose. Like, I'm kind of excited for those kind of jumps.
I'm not this year.
Well, I mean, obviously.
Zion makes a lot of sense for the Timberwolves.
Cavs independent, I am excited for those kind of jumps because they do make the league very interesting.
No, and imagine if that happens to Boston where the Kings pick jumps up to two. Like, I'll be livid.
Well, that'll suck, but whatever. You have to, you know. I'm talking a large, wide area.
That's why I worry about Zion being the next Anthony Bennett, and when we could just draft RJ and sign Bennett, and then you basically get the two top guys in this draft. The one thing that I think is worth noting, Trevor, I know you didn't like necessarily say this straight up, but it does feel like at least the guys with in terms of what their ceilings could be, it seems like Zion and RJ are the top tier there. And if you look at lottery odds like 1 through 4, because I think the Cavs are basically guaranteed to have a bottom four record. Kevin Love's going to be out for another month and a half here, and they're pretty ass right now. Like, it's the same odds. Like, the bottom three picks have the exact same odds to either get a number one or number two pick, and same with number three. And then if you fall down to fourth in lottery odds, it's only about a 2% drop off that you don't get one of those two guys. So I think if you land like 3 through maybe 6, I think you still like it's a lottery ticket at that point. Like, there's guys that have flaws that might hit, that might have a better work ethic than we realize, or make some sort of leap we don't see, same as every year. So to me, I'm not too concerned about where the Cavs finish as long as it's in that bottom four, because at that point it's just a crapshoot. It's just kind of the luck of the ping pong balls.
Yeah, I think the thing to remember with that, though, is at the end of the day, yeah, every pick's a lottery pick, but you still have to have the team that makes the right decision, invest the right caliber of development into that player to actually help him become that guy. You know, it's not every day that Sacramento picks 6 and lucks into Boogie Cousins. That is the exception, not the rule. And at the end of the day, would I rather have the Cavs drafting 2nd or 1st, where I know that they're going to get a guy who at least should be pretty good? Or do I want them gambling on somebody at the 6th pick where there's going to be a guy who's going to become a star at that, from that 6 to 10 range? Do I trust the Cavs to take that guy and identify that guy?
Right, but my point is, like, where they finish, like, people that are freaking out over one individual win, it doesn't change your odds of landing that 1st or 2nd pick as long as you're landing in that bottom three. So, obviously, the only thing it does change is how far you could fall back. And my point is that, I mean, as soon as you fall out of those top two or three guys, because I still put Reddish in there, I still kind of believe in him, just less than those other two. As soon as you fall out of that, I think it basically comes down to development, because I think there's a lot of guys in that tier that are very similar. And I agree, you want to pick a higher if you can. But I think once you miss out on those top three, if it happens that way, then you kind of got a long road ahead of you.
Yeah, I think that the you're right in that the level of picking 6 and picking it, it's almost the opposite problem of last year, where last year we were hoping that one of the guys in the 3 to 6 range fell to 8 because a couple teams made a couple mistakes out front. Now you're hoping that the one guy that you might have 3rd or 4th on your board falls to 8 because all of the options look pretty uninspiring, and there's a pretty good chance that nobody is going to have a consensus number 3, number 4 guy. So I think that there's a situation where the Cavs might cover the guy as the third best player. Maybe that's Little, maybe that's Reddish, and other teams don't think that way. And they could end up getting the guy that they want at 8 or 6, because there's just going to be so much volatility with how teams are going to scout this draft. That's the one takeaway I have. At the top of this draft, nobody has any idea what they're doing, even more so than your typical draft. And I think that's what's going to be really interesting moving forward, is how do these teams value all of these guys who are kind of at the similar level that isn't at the level of what you typically expect of maybe a 5th pick or an 8th pick. But somebody who's going to have that value is going to end up slipping, because everybody's going to value these guys so differently.
Right, right. Man, it's certainly not going to be easy. I think draft lottery day is going to be one of the most stressful moments of all of my time being a sports fan. Like, it feels like this draft is so important to the Cavs that you kind of got to hit on this one, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this team is horrible.
Yeah. I honestly, Trevor, like, I understand. I feel a little bit better about Zion, and I think that was a big goal of this podcast. But I'm very in on RJ, because a lot of kind of the talking points there of, okay, he can be kind of your lead scorer, but I don't know if he's a guy you can build the offense around. Like, that, to me, that screams like a lot of the Kyrie experience again. And I'm in for a player that's interesting and divisive like that. And not to mention he's Canadian. That might be.
Yeah, let's be honest with what we're doing here.
I mean, there's a lot of factors there. I mean, part of my concern was I just had so many, like, I had a few guys that I'd want over Zion, just because I feel like they're more kind of conventional players, guys that I can wrap my head around. And I do think that if you're in position to draft Zion, you just kind of have to do it. But my dream outcome is still for the Cavs to get the 2nd pick. That's what I'm rooting for, both selfishly and even though it's probably clouded by my biases here, both towards shooting and towards Canada. I just want the Cavs to be in position to get RJ at 2.
I think we
We're cowards. We both, me and Justin, are steadfastly on Landis at 2, baby.
Oh yeah, hell yeah,
the well, coward's pick.
Yeah, I think the thing that helps that is we know that if the Cavs get the 1 pick, Dan Gilbert will spend exactly 7 seconds on YouTube, and Zion is the pick if they pick 1.
Oh, it's absolutely
the
pick.
There's no conversation. It will be dunked.
Well, I don't want to pass on Zion if we win, because I don't want everyone to laugh at us for passing on Zion. I'm very externally focused right now. It's not healthy.
It's weird how all of the good and bad tendencies of this team all kind of combine together to point us in a direction that might for once actually be the correct option.
No, absolutely. And you know what? Like,
peer pressure us home, guys.
I have nightmares that, like, all my concerns about Zion, like, oh, he only creates in transition and off offensive rebounds and durability and that. Like, if the worst case scenario happens with Zion, I'm not going to be right. It's going to be people saying that the Cavs ruined him. And, like, I'm not mentally ready for that. People are already on their high horse of, oh, the Cavs don't deserve the pick. You should go to the Bulls, where they can surround him with cheap talent for a couple of years until he wants to die.
Like, yeah, noted functional front offices, the Bulls and the Knicks and the Suns, better options than the Cavs. Definitely.
I've seen Bulls and Wizards fans on my timeline saying that, oh, the Cavs don't deserve it. The Washington or Chicago should get it. I mean, Chicago's the exact same thing as Cleveland. You had one player that made your team relevant. Like, it's Michael Jordan and LeBron. And don't give me Derrick Rose. Derrick Rose is just Mark Price. That was the Mark Price era. Anyways, Trevor, we really do appreciate you coming on and listening to our rambling and dropping some knowledge bombs on us, because we definitely need it. I mean, you're talking about speaking to people that analyze, like, how Zion lands and stuff like that, and that goes
well. Yeah, I don't know any biomechanics people. I don't even know, like, one. It's humiliating.
And, yeah, our analysis never really gets to that level. So go ahead, buddy. Plug your stuff. Let the people know where they can find you.
So I'm doing weekly watch guides at Fear the Sword. If you have any interest in watching college basketball. I started that post at the beginning of the year with the phrase, as the Cavs season becomes more unwatchable by the game. And so far, I've just been able to copy and paste that and then just fill in the rest of the schedule. It's been great. So if you're looking for college basketball stuff to watch, whether you're paying attention for a Cavs bias or just are generally interested in the draft, each games to watch this each week will be going up at Fear the Sword, and all of my lengthier draft stuff is going to be at the Step Back. Thanks for having me on, and I look forward to doing this again in June.
Also, follow him at Illegal Screens, guys. Follow on Twitter, one of my favorite follows out there. You're right, though. The Cavs are a campaign to watch these days, but we'll get by it. We appreciate our listeners from sticking with us, even though the team sucks. Appreciate you coming on. Remember, guys, if you want to support the podcast, you can do so by leaving a rating, review, subscribe, unsubscribe, tell your friends and family about the podcast. And if you want to be part of our Discord chat, send a little screenshot of the review to chasedownpod@gmail.com, and we'd be more than happy to respond with an invite link to the Discord chat. So thanks again to Trevor. Until next time, go Cavs.
All right, Justin, if you could send me the audio, that'd be great.